Welcome everybody to this course, which I see from the screen is Libertarianism and Philosophers. I want to welcome you to the course. Now, this session is a bit different from the other sessions because I'm here at the Mises Institute for Mises University, and I'm broadcasting from the Mises Institute. So we have we're fortunate we have a very good computer. In one way, this isn't so good because before, if you thought going on my computer at home, if you think I'm kind of goofy looking, you can blame the screen. But this time, if you think that you're seeing me the way I really am, so I can't blame the computer mistakes for that. So now, what I want to do in this course, very often when we're reading Office of the Mises Institute, we tend to concentrate on writers who are very important thinkers to libertarians, such as Mises, Rothbard, Hans Hoppe. These have very important philosophical contributions. But in most university departments, these thinkers aren't studied much as philosophers. Mises get quite a bit of attention in some places as economists. But if you go to, let's say, philosophy class at Harvard or UCLA or Berkeley, you're not going to get much on Rothbard, Mises, or Hans Hoppe's philosophy. So I think it's important, if we want to understand philosophy, to study some of the important thinkers in philosophy, the ones that they study in mainstream department. In some cases, they've had important things to say about libertarianism. Now, my last lecture is a bit different, because that'll be on Hans Hoppe's and Frank Van Dunn's argumentation ethic. But what I'm going to be doing in most of the course is to go over some philosophers who are very well thought of in contemporary philosophy and see what they have to say. Now, one thing I'd like to say, if you can stay with me in the course, that you'll get something out of if I manage to do things correctly, is that you'll get a good understanding of some of the important systems in contemporary moral philosophy. So if you decide to take courses or do reading in contemporary philosophy, you'll have an understanding of what some of the main systems are. Now, the first author I want to consider is one who is both a libertarian and someone who's extremely well regarded in mainstream philosophy, and that's Robert Nozick. Now, I should say I knew Nozick very well for about 20 years, and he was an extraordinarily bright person. Now, there's some people I've seen various posts on certain blogs, I'm not going to mention any names, but who tend to be very dismissive of Nozick. Say, oh, well, you know, he was just a kind of not really systematic thinker. He didn't have really much importance to say. There are obvious mistakes in his argument. Now, I myself don't accept the main conclusion of part one of his famous book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia. I just want to urge you to understand he was a very impressive thinker. If you think that he's easy to dismiss or refute, you're going to find it's not true. If you have objections to what he said, you can usually be sure he's thought of the objection, has some answer to that. He's like in a chess game or going against one of the great players. He's thought of all the possibilities and come up with counters to them. So if you want to come up with answers to him, he's going to be very difficult to respond to, although I think there are problems with his argument. What I'm going to be discussing in this lecture, in his famous book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia, which came out in the end of 1974, he raises an argument against libertarian anarchism. Now remember, we all know what libertarianism is. I is, I hope that all people who are in this, interested in these and science, will know what libertarianism is. It's a system where each person has certain rights, very definitely including private property rights. And if the property rights are not assigned by the government, we have the right to acquire to homestead property, to acquire it by homesteading, by trading, by gifts from people who already have a property. And the role of government, if there is any, is simply justice and protection of people's rights. We don't have libertarian system, we don't have welfare rights, we don't have massive government we have now. Now, there's a dispute among libertarians. Some people, and I'm one of these, think that everything can be handled by the free market, including defense and protection. So in a libertarian society, there would be competing protection agencies. There wouldn't be a monopoly government agency. Those are people who hold that view are libertarian anarchists. And the opposing position, they're called minarchists. And this word was coined by Sam Konkin, who is a very interesting libertarian thinker. He was an anarchist. So a minarchist says, well, we want the free market, individuals have private property rights. We shouldn't have a state that does more than enforce people's private property rights and protect them. But defense, protection, justice should be handled by a government agency, a single agency, not competing agencies. So Nozick, in part one of Anti-State Utopia, is trying to argue against libertarian anarchism and for minarchism. He has a very complicated argument. Before I get into the argument, let me just give you one example. I think Nozick was a very good sense of humor. In one example, a story he told me, he said when he was a grad student, he took a course from Hillary Putnam, and Putnam had as his, one of the questions on the final exam was, write your own question and answer it. That was the question on the exam, write your own question and answer it. So Nozick's question for write your own question and answer it was, write your own question and answer it. And his answer was, write your own question and answer. So if you think that's funny, you'll probably like Anarchy State Utopia. Okay, so as I say, what Nozick is doing is arguing against libertarian anarchism. Now, how does he propose to do this? Well, he has what I think is a very ingenious idea. He says, suppose we're asking now, supposing, I'm assuming a lot of you are libertarian anarchists, you say, how could you argue successfully against libertarian anarchism? Now, one way you could do it is, say you had a different view of political theory, you attempt to argue in support of your theory, say you had a theory like, what they say, like Hegel did, where you think the state is extremely important, so you argue in favor of this philosophy. Then you say libertarianism is wrong because we really need a powerful state. People really derive their whole being from the state, so therefore we can't have anarchism. But then the anarchist could just say, well, I don't accept the premises that you're starting with. So libertarian anarchists would be inclined just to dismiss these competing political theories. You say, well, you're arguing on a different basis from the ones that we accept. So even if you have an argument from your own premises that anarchism is wrong, why should that matter to us? We're not going to be convinced by what you say. So Nozick thinks he can get out of this problem. As I say, he thinks he can show that anarchism is false using premises the anarchist can't reject. So if he can do this, this is a very powerful strategy, because he's saying to the anarchists, look, you can't dismiss the premises I'm starting with because you yourself must accept these. You can't reject them. So I can show from these premises there's something wrong with libertarian anarchism, then your position is really in trouble. You see how this strategy is supposed to work. Now, how does he achieve this goal? Remember, what he wants to do is to say that he wants to start with premises that the libertarian anarchists can't reject. And then he wants to say, well, I can show, get started with these premises, that there's going to be a problems with libertarian anarchists. So he's what is the thing the anarchists can't reject? Well, one thing that libertarian anarchists can't reject is the very system of libertarian anarchy. So he says, well, let's start with libertarian anarchism. And the starting point is the type of society supported by Murray Rothbard. If you might say, you could think of what he's doing is starting with, say, the society that Rothbard describes in Ethics of Liberty, and saying, okay, let's start with that. So, as I say, a libertarian anarchist is one who's Rothbardian persuasion can't object to that, because we're starting with the libertarian anarchist starting point. Could you hold on 1 second, please? Somebody's at the door. I'm glad someone said that we can't reject the starting point. At least the anarchists can't reject the starting point. So I should say that Murray Rothbard had a great influence on Nozick. Nozick developed some of his ideas in response to Rothbard. They met and had at least several long conversations. Now, unfortunately, the two of them didn't get along personally, especially Nozick really didn't like Murray Rothbard. Rothbard wasn't too happy with him, but it was much less of a dislike than Nozick had for Rothbard. And since I knew both of them, I was kind of sometimes caught in the middle, because each of them didn't like the fact that I was friendly with the other, although I was much closer to Rothbard as a friend to Nozick, but it got me into trouble that people were always ganging up on me, not that I'm paranoid, of course. All right, so as I say, Rothbard really had a great influence on Nozick. I hope people were laughing. I was trying to make some jokes there. You know, it's very important in my classes to laugh at my jokes. Okay, so what Nozick is trying to do is to say that if we start with from the anarchist starting point, we can show that people in it will abandon anarchism. So we're starting with Rothbardian anarchism, and Nozick wants to show that people abandon it so that the Rothbard theory is thus self-undermining. Say if you start with this, if you start with this Rothbardian system, it will undermine itself. Okay, so if Nozick is successful in this, the anarchists won't be able to argue your support for the minimal state rests on premises that I reject. But of course, he isn't rejecting the premise. We're starting with the premises that the anarchist is accepting, namely the system itself of libertarian anarchism. Okay, now Neil, with that is very right. If people can't see me, I hope you can see just picture a droopy dog. One person commented that I sound like droopy dog on sleeping pills, which I think is quite true. So just if you can't see me, just think of droopy dog. I hope most of you can see me because you're supposed to get video on this. So now, suppose it knows its argument is successful. I don't think it is, but we're going to put this sign up. That they suppose the argument is successful that Rothbardian anarchism is self-undermining. If you start with Rothbardian anarchism, you'll have to leave that position. So know that we still have to face this objection. Even if you've shown that libertarian anarchism is self-undermining, this doesn't show that the minimal state is justified. Because all you've shown is if you start with libertarian anarchism, you'll get to a minimal state, you'll get to minarchism. But that doesn't show minarchism is right, because maybe there's something wrong with libertarian anarchism to begin with, so it isn't a good starting point. You see what the problem is. You say, if this argument is right, it's a good argument against libertarian anarchists, but what about other people? What if libertarian anarchism isn't the correct system? But Nozick wouldn't find this objection persuasive because he thinks, and I think he's right about it, that Rothbard's starting point is a good one. He thinks that people do have libertarian rights, and that these rights are fairly close to the one that Rothbard favored. So Nozick is very much a libertarian. His point of view in rights is very similar to Rothbard. He's not an opponent of Rothbard. He's thinking people have a completely different set of rights from the one Rothbard has. So what he's trying to do is he's trying to do more than show that libertarian anarchism is self-undermining. Rather, since libertarianism is the proper starting point, getting to the minimal state from there justifies the minimal state. So what he's saying is, if you start with libertarian anarchism, I can show you can get to the minimal state, and this is a good place to start. This is the right place to start. Therefore, the minimal state is justified. So you see, this is quite a substantial burden he's taking. If he's successful, he's argued for something that's very important conclusion. Now, a lot of people that are familiar somewhat with anti-state utopia, they make a common mistake about Nozick's argument. I've seen people make this mistake, written about it. It's a serious mistake. They have a wrong idea about the structure of Nozick's argument. They think that the argument goes something like this. I said, if you start with libertarian anarchy, you can get to a minimal state through a series of steps that lead to a minimal state. So I say, you're starting with libertarian anarchism, then there's a series of steps that get you to a minimal state. Now that's not wrong in the sense that the argument doesn't have this structure. It does have a system of, it has a structure that you start with libertarian anarchism, then there's a series of steps that get you to a minimal state, but that isn't the full structure of the argument. It's much more than that. If you want to get what the argument is about, then you have to see it's much more than that. Because if this were all there was to the argument, this was all there was, it wouldn't be a very good argument. Remember, you have, as long as you say you're starting with libertarian anarchism, then there's a series of steps you can take, say, that don't violate anybody's rights. I should put that in. Start with libertarian anarchism. You can get by a series of steps that don't violate anybody's rights. You can get to the minimal state. So that would be a very good argument. Let's take this up to show what's wrong with it. Suppose all of you gave me all your money. Now that wouldn't violate anybody's rights. You have a right, it's your money, you have a right to do with it what you want. And you say you all chose to give me the money. Now this would be very good for me, but you have no reason to do so. I hope you do anyway. You know, you can always send me money. I can always use it. Give what you have and sell what you have and give it to me. That sounds like a good idea. But it wouldn't be, from your own point of view, it wouldn't be a very good thing to do. So you see, if Nozick's argument were just, well, there's a series of steps that don't violate anybody's rights that can get you to the minimal state, it wouldn't be much of an argument because it might be a very bad thing to get to the minimal state and just wouldn't violate anybody's rights. So for a successful argument, Nozick needs to show that each of the steps that you take from libertarian anarchism to the minimal state is either to people's advantage or else is required by morality. Then he has a much stronger argument to say, well, you start with libertarian anarchism and then people will be doing things that they think is in their own interest and this will get them to the minimal state or the things will be required by morality. It won't just be that they don't violate anybody's rights, but they'll be morally required to take these steps. So see, that would give him, if he can pull this off, which I don't think he's able to, this would give him a very strong argument, you see. Now, Nozick starts, when we're in this system, starting in the rough audiences, where each person has certain libertarian rights, including property rights. So he assumes, and this is certainly something Rothbard also assumed, that people will join protective associations or protection agencies to enforce their rights. Probably what you could, if you want, just rely on your own, just try to enforce your rights yourself. You say if somebody steals from you, you could just say, well, I'm going to go after this person myself. But you probably wouldn't want to do that. You would say in a libertarian society there would be the equivalent of a police department that you would subscribe to who would enforce your rights, or it would be a private court system. People probably wouldn't be doing everything just by themselves because most people don't have enough, very few people have enough individual force to go up against criminals. So we would just delegate this to protection agencies. Now, Nozick also assumes, and then this is one assumption also Rothbard makes, is that everyone, or almost everyone, accepts the same libertarian law code. So we're assuming a society where almost everyone accepts libertarian rights. So everybody accepts libertarian rights. And they're all joining, or most people are joining, protective associations, protection agencies. So they all accept the same libertarian law code. However, even though they accept the same law code, this still leaves room for differences of opinion. For example, agencies could differ on what procedures should be used in assessing guilt. For example, suppose you had one agency said, oh, we want to, if somebody's accused of a crime, he has to be convicted by a jury of 12 people. And another one said, no, we think it's enough for a majority vote. You could imagine all sorts of different procedures different agencies might have to enforce, to decide on guilt. So that would be one example of how, even though people accept the same basic legal principles, there could still be differences of opinion among the agencies. You wouldn't get each agency having exactly the same procedures. And you'll see later, very shortly, this point is extremely important in Nozick's argument that the agencies might have different procedures for assessing guilt. Now, supposing imagine this situation, say you're a client of one agency and you're in a dispute with somebody in a different agency, say you signed a contract with someone, you claim the other person's violated your contract. Let's just give an example. Say you have a contract that you're supposed to get a clear video, and you say the person you contracted with is not sending you a clear video, so you want some action. So supposing you're in a different agency from the person you're complaining about, so then there's a problem because one agency will want to settle the matter according to their procedures, and the other agency will say, no, let's follow the procedures of our agency. So what would you want if you're a client of a particular agency? You obviously want your agency to win in these disputes. Since you're in the agency, you've chosen that one, you prefer that the disputes be settled according to the procedures of your agency. You want your court system to decide these conflicts, not the other person's system. Now, so you want your agency to win. Now, what determines which agency will win? And Nozick is suing here if the agencies can't settle this dispute just by negotiating, that you could maybe justify them trying to use force to get their way. And what basically Nozick is assuming in this part of the argument is that the strength of an agency will be largely determined by the number of clients it has. So supposing you have an agency that has almost everybody in the society join that agency, then he's assuming, well, it'll be much stronger than an agency that doesn't have many clients. So now let's suppose we start off in a particular territory, say where there are competing agencies that are roughly the same size. Let's say one agency is somewhat larger than the others. So remember, we're assuming people want their agencies to win, and we're assuming the strength of an agency is pretty directly proportional to the number of clients in it. So supposing one agency is larger than the other, then it has an advantage, because if there are disputes, again, according to the assumption, it will tend to win. So people will then, Nozick thinks, be attracted to that agency, because they say, well, people, let's join that agency because that agency people will tend to win. And this will produce kind of in a spiraling process, more people will then join that agency because people will say, well, this agency will win, so let's join that. Like, if they join that, then the agency becomes even larger than it was before, and that increases its advantage. Then it becomes even more attractive to people, so more and more people attract clients, that we will attract more and more clients. I think there's an objection, a Lucas interesting objection. He doesn't think that people will choose services that provided by sports teams. Well, it's not that you're just picking an agency because you like watching fights and want that on the winning team. It's that you want if you're in disputes, you want the disputes to be settled according to your agency rather than the others, because you pick that agency because you like its procedures. So you want that to be the way that the disputes are settled. So now I see Ryan is anticipating my next tour. I hear like his comet in his comet. So and what you see here is Nozick is making an exception to the usual rule. There's no general tendency to monopoly on the free market. Here he thinks there is a tendency to monopoly on the free market, as he thinks that size is such an advantage. Normally, the free market, whether it isn't always the case that the bigger the firm, the better. That just depends on the conditions of a particular industry. But here he thinks size is an advantage because he assumes the more clients in an agency, the stronger it is. Now, there's an obvious objection here. I think it's actually one Nozick wasn't able to meet, is that he's assuming that in these disputes, one agency will say they can't settle the dispute, but instead let's do settle the dispute according to my procedure. The other one said, no, no, let's do it my way. Then if they'll just fight it out if they can't agree. But Nozick, I mean, one thing he's overlooking, this is one thing Rothbard points out, the agencies could come to sort of agreement, well, what will we do in case of disputes? Maybe we could agree to refer it to some appeals court. Maybe wouldn't this be better than fighting? Why don't they just agree on an appeals procedure? So this would invalidate what Nozick is saying. Now, what Nozick handles is he thinks that if the agencies agreed on the settlement way of settling these disputes, then that would make them one agency. They'd be kind of branches of the same agency. But we can wonder, this doesn't seem right. Wouldn't it just be that they have, they're still competing agencies, but they just have a dispute procedure. Say we have, say, in international law today, sometimes we have way nations agree on how to settle disputes by referring them to some kind of arbitration panel. There have been boundary disputes that have been settled that way between countries, but that doesn't make these two countries one country. So Nozick seems to be wrong there in thinking that if the agencies agreed, that would make them one agency. Now he also considers the possibility that if you start off with competing agencies in a territory, kind of you could have a system where the territory would be kind of split up and you'd have locally dominant agencies, but that doesn't really affect the main structure of the argument. So what he's basically saying is you get a dominant protected association, DPA. Now, let's suppose, and I don't think he's right, but let's suppose, we need to suppose this so we can see how the arguments go. Let's suppose Nozick is right that most people in a territory would join the same agency. So we're assuming now he's right. I think one person said maybe he's wrong and that the strength of an agency depends on the number of its clients. But suppose he's right in this kind of spiraling process that I've spoken about leads to most people joining the same agency. So assuming now, I don't think this is right, let's assume he is right. So this doesn't create a state. Why wouldn't this just be a particular type of libertarian anarchy? We could imagine a libertarian Rothbardian system where practically everybody likes one protection agency, they join that. That wouldn't cease to be a Rothbardian anarchist system. It would just be most people like one particular agency. Now, here's where the response to this, here's where Nozick shows his ingenuity. He asks, what can the DPA, the dominant agency, do to people who don't join the agency? What he says is, that it can prohibit, this dominant agency can prohibit other agencies and independents. Now, this is independents of people who aren't in an agency, people who just want to handle the protection and defense by themselves. He said they can, the dominant agency can prohibit these other agencies from using decision procedures on its client that it considers too risky. So let's make sure we understand what he's saying. Remember, these agencies are having disputes about what are the procedures you use in trying cases. Say, how do you determine someone's guilty? Say, someone has accused me of stealing something. What are the proper procedures that have to be used in determining my guilt or innocence? So imagine these agencies have different views about what the proper procedures are. So he's thinking that, supposing the dominant agency says, well, here are the proper procedures, the ones we use, and there are other procedures that some other agency uses that are too risky. Say the dominant agency said, we want to have jury trials where you have to have 12 people unanimously voting for conviction of anybody to be found guilty. So we think a system where you say we need only 9 votes would be too risky. So we're prohibiting these other agencies from using these procedures. So we say we're prohibiting this. I see just a quick question from Jock. He said he doesn't see why competition would lead to the initiation of force. Well, I see what Nozick is assuming is it isn't just that these agencies are competing, but we have a case where a client of one agency is in a dispute with a client of the other agency, and then each agency wants to settle the dispute in court with its own procedures. So he's thinking that if the agencies can't come to an agreement about what procedures to use, then the agencies can use force to apply their own procedure. That's the assumption he's making. So the dominant DPA is saying we're going to prohibit other agencies from using risky procedures. I don't want to spend too much time answering these questions now because I want to get through the main lecture and listen to the discussion. But someone has raised the difficulty that using force violates the non-aggression principle. Well, Nozick doesn't think it does because they're not aggressing. They're just saying that the procedures we consider fair for deciding guilt should be used, and if you don't want to use them, then you're doing something you have no right to do, and we impose procedures on our clients that we consider risky. So that's why he doesn't think it's a violation of the non-aggression principle. Okay, now, you might object to what I'm saying. I see people are already objecting to what Nozick said, that he slipped in an unjustified assumption. Remember, Nozick said the dominant agency can prohibit other agencies and independents from applying risky decision procedures to its clients. Now, the question you might ask is, why does the dominant agency get to prohibit procedures that it considers too risky when other agencies don't? Why does its size or its dominance confer additional rights on it? So why is it, you know, it says the dominant agency can prohibit procedures it doesn't accept? Why does it get this right? What about the other agencies? Why can't they prohibit procedures that they don't like? So, but Nozick doesn't assume that the dominant DPA has more rights. Other agencies are free to try to prohibit procedures they deem too risky. But the point is that the DPA will win in case of confrontation because it's the strongest agency. So you aren't, and now here are the questions people are asking. See, is why this prohibition doesn't violate anybody's right. It's that you don't have a right to use risky decision procedures. So if you try to do that, then someone else can stop you. However, there's a dispute about what the risky decision procedures are, so everyone can act on his own assessment of what risky procedures are. And the DPA is the one that's going to win because it's the strongest agency. So the DPA can say to some other agency, you can't use risky decision procedures. It's not claiming rights that other people don't have, because no one has the right to use risky decision procedures, but there are conflicting views about it, so each agency or group is going to act on the assumption that it's right and the dominant agency, the DPA, will win. Now, you can see, even if you don't agree with this, at least it's kind of interesting, kind of convoluted, if you like. Intricate arguments, this is part of the attraction of Gnosis. Now, there's a natural objection here, is that the prohibition of risky procedures is unjustified. Let's imagine a client of the DPA's dominant agency commits a crime against a client of another agency. Now, that other agency, let's say, tries this client of the DPA using a risky procedure. Let's say I'm a client of the dominant agency and I'm accused of stealing something by somebody in a different agency. Now, this other agency tries me, puts me on trial, and finds me guilty, even though only 9 people have voted that I'm guilty. Of course, I am guilty. I might steal everything except a red hot stove, but they said I'm not guilty, but they only find me guilty by 9 votes, 3 people I was able to convince that I was innocent. Now, they've used a risky procedure, so you might, so supposing, let's just show you that, supposing I actually was innocent this one time and I don't steal everything. I was falsely accused, so I'm really innocent, but they found me guilty, and they've used this risky procedure on me. Then, if it turns out, if it can be shown that I'm innocent, then can't I just get compensation by the other agency? So then, if this procedure were followed, then the dominant agency wouldn't be able to determine the procedures used in the territory and wouldn't be a state. See, what Nozick is thinking is, if the dominant agency can say, well, we're the agency that gets to determine what are the decision procedures to be used in trial for finding people guilty, then that's sufficiently like a state that we can say the dominant agency is a state. But if we have to rely just on compensation for use of risky decision procedures by other agencies, then it wouldn't be a state. So why can't we say that all that happens is if an agency using a risky decision procedure on clients of the dominant agency, all it has to do is get, it can get people who are wrongly found guilty, can get compensation, and then we don't get a state from that. Now, Nozick has a response to this. This is, now we're getting to the heart of his argument for the minimal state. What he says is that certain kinds of punishment generate fear. If you think a risky procedure might lead to your execution or imprisonment under harsh position, you would be afraid. Let me give you an example. I understand it's a case in Malaysia that if you fly into that country and you're bringing certain drugs like heroin with you, you get the death penalty. So let's suppose, I don't know if this is the case in Malaysia, let's suppose they had extremely unreliable procedures to find out if people were bringing in drugs. Let's say there were a lot of cases where people had been wrongly found to brought in drugs and they were executed. So when you think you'd be really afraid to go there, just the thought that you might be executed under this, under a procedure that was very risky, you get be very afraid. So you feel quite a bit of fear about this, if there was a risky decision procedure that might result in death or serious harm to you. So we could raise the same objection here that we've given before. And someone, Jock says Thailand is a better example. Well, I didn't know that. I never tried to smuggle drugs into Thailand. Maybe I won't try it. Thanks for your advice. So could we raise the same objection that we did before? Even if you say people feel fear, couldn't people wrongly convicted get compensation for this fear in addition to other damages? Maybe the problem about, say you're talking about people with executions, and aside from that, can we just say all that would happen here is you're entitled to additional compensation? We don't have an argument for prohibition of the procedure. We just say, well, if you use these procedures and you find someone who is guilty is really innocent, then you have to pay them compensation, not just compensation for that you otherwise would have paid, the additional compensation because they're afraid, because of the fear these punishments generate. Now, Nozick, as I said, you know, Nozick always anticipates objections, he has an answer. So he says, well, when these punishments generate fear, they'll generate the fear, this fear, even in those who are never falsely accused. Let's say you have to go to Thailand and Malaysia regularly, and you don't bring in any drugs, but you're never accused of it. But you always have to be afraid because they use risky decision procedures. You're always afraid. Oh, what if I go in there and they falsely accuse me of taking in drugs, and I'm going to be in really big trouble? So you're feeling very fearful about this. But you're not going to get any compensation for this extra fear because there are no cases that it will involve you. You'll never be accused by hypothesis of these crimes that will generate the fear, but you'll have to have the fear anyway, but you're not going to get compensation for it. So this is the reason Nozick thinks that the DPA can prohibit risky decision procedures, and it need not confine itself to compensation. So see, this is very important because we need, for it to get a minimal stake, we have to have the DPA being able to determine what are the decision procedures that are used throughout the territory. We were just relying on compensation, we said if these other agencies can use their own procedures, but if people are found wrong and found guilty, then they have to compensate those people, then we wouldn't have a state, anything like a minimal state, even if there were a dominant agency. Now, supposing we have then a dominant agency that prohibits any decision procedures on its clients that it considers risky. So Nozick calls this an ultra-minimal state. Now, what he says here is that the ultra-minimal state can't just stay there as an ultra-minimal state. This would be forbidden by morality. It would be violating proper moral constraint if it just was an ultra-minimal state. All it did was say, well, we're prohibiting everyone else from using risky decision procedures. Because if it prohibits independents from imposing risky decision procedures on clients, it's disadvantaging them. It's saying those people won't be able to use the procedures on its clients that it considers the right people, the right procedures to use. Because, of course, remember, the whole problem arises because there's disputes about risky decision procedures. one agency thinks these are the proper procedures, the other one will say, no, these are too risky. We think these are the, this is the proper procedures we should use. So each agency or independent thinks it's the right, doing the right thing. So these independents aren't doing anything wrong in imposing, they're not doing anything morally wrong in imposing procedures they consider justified on the clients within the agency. It's just that they have different views on decision procedures from the DPA. They're not doing anything that's wrong. It's not wrong to have different views from the DPA on proper decision procedures, just that in the absence of some objective standard, each agency or independent is justified in trying to enforce its own procedures, and the DPA is the one that's going to win. This is what he's assuming. So the DPA is disadvantaging the people, the independents that's prohibited from using the decision procedure that those independents prefer. So because it's disadvantaged, Scott says risky just equals different. Well, it's different in how they, what, not any difference, just difference in what they consider the proper level of risk in the procedures and what procedures they consider risky. So it's just different along that one dimension. So he says because the DPA has disadvantaged these independents, then it has to compensate them. It's put them at a disadvantage, or it has to give them something because it's disadvantaged. And what it can, the way it can compensate them is by offering low cost or free protection packages to them. So this transforms the DPA dominates the interminimal state. And why is that? Because it's providing protective services to everybody, both to its own clients and the independents that it has to compensate by offering these low cost or free protection packages. And it's not selling its protective services at market prices, so it's sufficiently wide to state the counters one. So say if we had just imagine everybody joined the same agency and the agency charges the market price, that wouldn't be a minimal state. It would just be a private protection agency that everybody happens to like. But here, as Moses is thinking that, it would be very much like, especially like a state account is one, because some people, namely independents who were being compensated because they couldn't apply risky procedures to the client, would be getting protection below cost, so other people would have to pay higher prices to cover the cost to them. So we wouldn't have market prices for the protective services, so that makes it a minimal state. Now, then you might object to what Nozick is saying that, well, if they start providing protective services to these independents, low cost or no cost protective services, then wouldn't people other than the independents want low cost or free protection? Say, somebody said, well, I'm an independent, I have my own risky decision procedure, so the DPA prohibits me from applying these procedures and it compensates me by offering me a very low cost protective package, then won't everybody else say, why shouldn't I get such a package? But Nozick thinks this wouldn't happen because remember the compensation that's offered the independents is just a bare bones package. They would just get kind of minimal protection and people who paid more would get better protection. Now, it's important to realize also in Nozick's system there isn't any taxation, just like in Ayn Rand's notion of minimal state. There isn't any taxation, but if you don't join the dominant agency, say you don't, or you don't accept the protection package they're offering, then you would probably, you might find it very difficult to force contractors to respond to rights violations that involve the clients of the damaged agency, because you wouldn't be able to apply the procedures you thought were right in trying to deal with them. So you would have a pretty good incentive to join the damaged agency, if at least it knows if it's right. Now, as you can see, you probably don't accept this argument. You can at least see it's complicated. And I haven't given you all the complications. You can see it's a very complicated argument. I want to, in the time remaining, I want to give some problems with the argument. From the chat, a lot of you have problems with it already, but I think the problems I have in mind might be a bit different from the ones that you were thinking of. At least I hope so, because I have to come up with some original material for my course. Otherwise, maybe I should be in the audience and you'd be giving the course. I have to be able to come up with new points. Now, one problem that I think Nozick has is in the argument that he gives for the EPA. Remember, we're having this kind of spiraling process people are joining the agency because it's bigger. I see somebody like prorated refunds. Well, I hope you don't do that. You don't put that into practice for my course. Do it for somebody else's course, please. Okay, so everybody's supposed to join the agency, and then more and more people join the agency, it becomes stronger, so you have kind of a spiraling effect in people then keep joining the agency. Now, the problem that we get into here for Nozick is the argument can't be too successful, because if everybody joins the EPA, then it's simply a private agency with a large clientele and not a state. So what he needs is that almost everybody joins, or a lot of people join, but then some people don't, because they have to be people who are enough independents around so that the dominant agency can prohibit these independents and people in other agencies from applying risky decision procedures. So Nozick's really arguing against himself because well, there's this spiraling process, but it has to end at a point to leave some independents around. But if he's right, it's not clear why the spiraling process should end, why it wouldn't just take in everybody. And I think the best objection to Nozick's whole argument is raised by Ronald Hamway, who's been here, incidentally, been here this week at the Mises University. He's a great friend of mine, known him over 30 years, most sarcastic person I've ever met, I should add. He and I are planning an article on Nozick's derivation in the minimal state. Now, he has the best objection to Nozick. Now, what he thinks is that, again, remember, we had raised the objection, well, why can the DPA prohibit risky decision procedures? Why doesn't it just have to say that if another agency uses risky procedures, it has to compensate anyone who's wrongly found guilty? And Nozick says, well, but look about this fear that certain kinds of punishment generate, and this people will feel fear, even those who were never accused of anything, so they're not going to get any compensation. Now, what Hanaway points out is that the compensation that's offered to those who are wrongly convicted can be high enough so that even those who are never charged find the situation acceptable. So supposing, again, let's imagine I'm going into Thailand, I think, ooh, I'm really scared because I'm not taking any drugs. What if they wrongly accuse me, then I'm going to be in big trouble, so I'm quite afraid. Well, let's suppose I knew that if I went in and I was wrongly found guilty, I'd get some really enormous compensation. I'd get several $1 million. So that might be enough that I'd accept that. I might say the prospect of getting compensated if I were wrongly accused makes this acceptable to me, even though I'm not getting compensated for my actual fear. The chance that sort of bit like a lottery, I think, well, if I were ever in that bad state, I'd do all right. So I'm willing to accept that. So if this is right, knows it really doesn't have a good case against compensation. So he can't really justify this prohibition of risky decision procedures on this special kind of fear that he's concerned with. Now, we can really raise an additional objection. Now, the ones we've raised so far may be a bit complicated, but there's kind of a simpler objection we can raise, is that Nozick seems to have overestimated the importance of differences in about decision procedures. Why should we think that these would really represent major sources of conflict? Nozick is imagining some big battles among the agencies just because they have different decision procedures. But why would agencies think, why would we imagine such great disputes about what the proper procedures are that each agency would be really doubtful about that the other agency's procedures were too risky? Maybe wouldn't it be more reasonable to think there's some kind of people are pretty much agreed on proper procedures within certain limits and the differences might not be that important to them? Also, why would we think that the dominant agency would have procedures that by its own standard are less risky than competitors? See, if you were a client of an agency, you would want procedures, you would think that if you were accused of a crime, you would want procedures that were not worth, make sure that you wouldn't be found guilty if you were innocent. But you would also want it to be the case that if people did things to you, you would want them to be found guilty. So as long as you think that you're not likely to be charged with any crimes, you might favor a more risky procedure than a less risky one. If people don't want to be wrongly convicted, but they also want criminals to be held accountable. So Nozick seems to be assuming that the DPA would be faced with competitors that had more risky decision procedures than it did by its own standards, but that might not be true. Now, another difficulty in Nozick's argument is I think he's overestimated the importance of punishments that inspire fear. Remember, what kind of punishment would inspire this kind of fear in you? You might think, well, say execution or punishment that involves serious bodily harm or being imprisoned under very harsh conditions. But very few cases involve these kinds of punishments. And besides, an agency could simply avoid punishment that generated fear of that kind. Then the DPA couldn't do anything about the procedures it used because it wouldn't be inspiring this kind of fear that knows it thinks justifying prohibition. Now, I want to conclude with an objection to Nozick that I don't think works. Now, if you remember, I put on the reading list that Journal of Libertarian Studies, Volume 1, Number 1, there's an argument that Roy Childs gives that Murray Rothbard discussed. Now, I think Rothbard is inclined to accept it. I don't think it really works. Now, Nozick, it's an ingenious argument. Remember, Nozick says you could go from Rothbardian anarchism to a minimal state. Now, Child thinks you could reverse the process. You could say minimal state is unstable, and you'll get back to anarchism. So the basic point in Child's argument is that because the dominant agency has to offer protection, independence is prohibited from using risky decision procedures, it has to compensate them by low cost or free protection. And then its prices are higher than the market price for protection. I mean, this is what we discussed before. This is why the dominant agency has become a state, because it's not charging market prices for its services. And it's determining the procedures for everybody, but not charging market prices. So Child says, well, if that was right, then some other agency could say, we're going to use exactly the same procedures as this minimal state, but so it can't do anything to us for using risky decision procedures because it's using the procedures that it itself considers the best one, but we'll be able to charge less because we don't have to pay these independents because we're not prohibiting them. It's the EPA that's prohibiting them. So we can undercut the prices that's offered by the dominant agency, you see. So we can undercut them and charge them less, so then this would restore competition, so there wouldn't be a dominant agency anymore. But what Childs is, I think, overlooking is that it's true that another agency could undercut the minimal state prices, but then it couldn't prohibit independents from applying risky decision procedures to its clients since it isn't compensating them. Remember, when the dominant agency prohibits these other agencies from applying risky decision procedures, it's not prohibiting them from applying these procedures to anybody. It's just prohibiting them from applying them to its own clients. So these competing agencies couldn't piggyback, as it were, on what the DPA is doing. If they wanted to prohibit independents from applying risky decisions to their own clients, they would have to compensate them. So I think Child's objection doesn't work. Well, I think what I'm trying to do is to go through some of the steps of Nozick's argument, and you can see it's a very complicated argument. I try to show why it doesn't work, but I think it's at least a very ingenious argument that we should consider seriously, even though I think there are serious problems with it. So when I see, just looking through the chat, there have been a lot of comments and objections. So we can start, I think the rest of the time we can have, nearly half hour left, we can have for questions and objections. I see one question here from Leslie is, why would it be in the interest of any agencies to use risky procedures? Well, remember, the problem is that there's a dispute on which of the procedures to use. Like, say, one agency could say, well, we think it's more important to not to let any people, criminals, go, so we're going to use slightly riskier procedures than some other agencies. Some other agencies could say, no, it's more essential that innocent people not be found guilty. So there could be legitimate differences of opinion on this point. Well, now, Danny's reminding me to remember questions on the other screen. Okay, so I'll remember that. Does anyone have any further questions on this lecture, then I can go on to the other screen. Am I missing anything now? Anybody have any objections? Let me see, maybe there's something down here. Well, let's see what we have over here. Wait, okay. Let's see what these questions are. Okay, now we have one question here. Now we have a question about something Rothbard is saying, where Rothbard says no one has the right to coerce anyone if not himself directly engaged in overt act of aggression against right. Any loosening of this criterion includes coercion against remote risk, substantial and permissible aggression against the rights of others. And so then James has a thought experiment where somebody has some kind of energy device that's likely to explode, and he wonders, don't you have some right to act against that, even if there is the person isn't intending any aggression against you, it's just that thing is going to likely explode. Well, I don't think this really goes against what Rothbard is saying. But what Rothbard has in mind is remote risks, and this wouldn't be a case of remote risk. This would be a case where there's something, an immediate danger of blowing up, so I think it would be justified in taking action. Now remember, whether something is justified in taking action against something wouldn't be dependent on just, say, whether the other person intends to do you harm. It would be sufficient if, in fact, it's likely to do you harm. Say, he's just a very careless person, just been very negligent, the thing's going to blow up. That would be sufficient for taking action. I think that Rothbard would have to say, well, this person didn't intend to, it isn't that he's planning to kill me by this device, it's just sufficient that it's likely to blow up. I see that we've had assumption how other people might try to deal with this, but I think basic point to remember here is that I think people are underestimating what you could do according to Rothbard's system in this kind of risky situation. It isn't that you're dependent on the neighbor agreeing not to use the device, if it's really likely to blow up, I think you could take action against it, as I explained. Now, let me see somebody else. People will cooperate. Now someone says Rothbard. Someone raised a question to defend that Rothbard is saying that Rothbard is wrong to say there's a slip once you're permitted to proceed beyond defense against a very act of actual aggression when you use force against someone because of his risky activity, then the sky is the limit. In short, there's then virtually no limit to aggression against the rights of others. And then James suggests this is a slippery slope fallacy. Well, again, I think this passage has to be probably wrong just as it stands, but I think what I would suspect Rothbard has really in mind, I think he's expressed himself too strongly in this sense, is just he's concerned that people will try to prohibit remote risks. But I think the dividing line would be something like it's a quite immediate risk versus something that's more remote, and then you could prohibit. There would be a fairly clear division there, I think. Okay, now someone wants to know, when Rothbard talks about uncertainty and risk, did he have in mind any Frank Knight's issues? No, he was very interested in that, but I don't think that's what he had in mind there. And then the last thing here is something on Rothbard criticizes knows of Kantianism. Do you need to abandon Kant to be a libertarian? Well, I don't think so. I mean, you could certainly take the view that, as Kant said, that individuals have ends who shouldn't be treated exclusively as means. You could certainly, that's certainly an appealing position. You don't have to accept Kant's particular philosophy in supporting that, but on the other hand, I don't think if you find that a good philosophy, I don't think there's any reason not to accept it. I don't see any contradiction between accepting kind of a Kantian view and accepting a libertarian position. That would just depend on what philosophy you find persuasive. Now, okay, so those are all the questions on the screen. Do people have additional points they want to raise on this lecture? Let me just see if I missed anything in the chat already. Let me just see here. Oh wait, here's one. Lucas said, And wouldn't an agency increase its strength of membership by promoting interaction more inclusive than prohibitive? And he thinks that if you start prohibiting things, it would cut off its very life force. Well, remember, you're certainly right that if it started prohibiting people in the agency, its own clients from doing things, that wouldn't be very attractive. But remember, what it's prohibiting is of people in other agencies from doing that, doing things to its clients. So it's not doing any prohibitions to people in the clients to other agencies. So I don't think that would, what you're suggesting, would work. Now let's see, there's an additional question. Patricio said he has a question in the Q&A session. Let me see if I can find that here. Wait a minute. You say in the Patricio, let me see, where's your question? Just a minute here. He says, I'm looking in the other scene. You mean in the Q&A. Wait, am I getting this in the right screen here? Wait. I don't see. Patricia, could you put your question in the chat section? There's this thing I can see is the questions people have posted to the Q&A on the course page. I think you put it on something else, or at least I'm not seeing what it is. Okay, now here I see the question. When we say we want a minimal state, are we talking about privatizing some of the activities currently provided by the federal or state government? Well, what it had, minimal state would just be one that was confined to protection and justice. So you would have, if you wanted to start off with a current state, you have to privatize almost all the activities they're doing. Now, one thing, your question is a very good question. The point that we have missed in Nozick's argument is Nozick thinks that minimal state is one that does the activities he thinks he justifies it. Protection defense, but it doesn't have to arise by starting with from a authoritarian anarchist position. That's how he shows it's justified. But let's suppose a group of Nozickians, everybody became a Nozickian, and that was both people, the Nozickian libertarian took over Congress and the presidency. Let's imagine Obama becomes a Nozickian. So then they start reducing the government down to minimal state. That would be all right, according to Nozick. The fact that we didn't start from reforming anarchism wouldn't matter. And I know that he told me that himself. So it isn't that you have to start with reforming anarchism. That's just how the justification process gets going, but it isn't that to be justified, it has to proceed in that way. Okay, now here's a question from Bob Williams. Let's say Hickman's risky neighbor turns out not to have a device. You imagine, we could certainly have cases where people falsely accuse others of having risky devices that they don't actually have. But I thought the case was, we're assuming they really do have a case. I mean, of course, if they don't, then you're not justified doing anything to them. So I think you're quite right. It's a very good point you raise that sometimes people falsely think others are engaged in risky behavior against them. So we could say in foreign policy, to say, well, certain countries plotting to send terrorists against us, but maybe they aren't. And then they say, well, we're going to attack that country because this country is a hotbed of terrorism. But it might turn out they're not, so you have to be very careful. So they want me to read the questions. Patricia wants to know how do we move from the current state to complete free market? Well, I guess, you know, once we have to get in people who are supporting libertarianism, then we could just start getting rid of the wrong government programs. And someone suggests make the state irrelevant. Jacques has a good comment. How on earth would a person with such a device, let's say one of these devices going to ball, could have made it into a position of sharing neighborhood with me? Well, I guess maybe he went crazy after they let him in. Okay, now there's another question from Ryan. If there exists minimal state that enforces personal rights and freedom, what is the impetus for individuals to form associations in the first place? Well, remember, Nozick isn't assuming that people would form associations if there's a minimal state. What he's really starting off with these associations is that he's saying, well, the Rothbardians want to start that way so I can show that if you start that way, you'll get to minimal state. Now, if you have a minimal state, well, why would any, you might find, say, people just weren't satisfied with the way it was doing things. They wanted to form their own protective agency. Sometimes people say they just thought they could do a better job or they just didn't like the way the other ones were doing things, so they might have all sorts of reasons to form their own association. Now, Kels, is that, I am pronouncing your right, name right, is that Kels? Kelsey, sorry. How does Nozick state compare to simple autocracy? Once it becomes the only protective agency, not only will it not be constrained by market competition, it won't even be constrained by democratic processes, right? Well, I think you're certainly right in practice that a monopoly agency would be a very bad thing to have, but one of the things that Nozick is assuming in this whole argument is that people accept libertarian rights. So of course you could have a system where people just take over the state and then start oppressing people, but he's assuming that everyone accepts libertarian rights, and he's trying to show that on that assumption we'll get to a minimal state. So it might be a good point in practice against them to say, even if you're right, there's too much danger that this minimal state will turn abusive. That might be a very good practical argument against his system. But what he's interested here is just to show in theory that the minimal state would work. I mean, it would be similar. We could come up with an analogous argument. Sometimes people argue against Rothbardian anarchism. Well, maybe an anarchist government wouldn't be able to survive in competition if powerful state decided to attack it. So I don't think that argument is right, but if it were right, that wouldn't be an argument against the theory of Rothbardian anarchism. It would just say there'd be practical difficulties in putting it into effect. So say your point would be a similar kind of practical argument, and well, I think it would be a good one actually, that the minimal state would be likely to become abusive, but it wouldn't be an objection to the theory of Nozick's argument. Now, Bob says, what's the appropriate role of any government society? And Jacques said, no. Well, I think that's actually right, and I think the Rothbardian anarchist position is the correct one, so it wouldn't have a role, but if it did have such a role, it would be just protection and justice. Certainly nothing beyond a minimal state is justifiable, and I don't think a minimal state is justifiable, so that doesn't leave us with anything. Okay, so we still have about another few minutes. Justin said, do you agree with Hoffman's views on Nozick from the introduction to the Rothbard Ethics of Liberty? Some of them seem to contradict how you interpret Nozick's argument. Justin, if you have particular points that Hans gives, I could go through with them. I interpret Nozick sort of in the way I think. If there's some dispute, I naturally favor my own interpretation. Now, there is one point I do disagree with Hans. He takes what I think to be a kind of a dismissive view of Nozick. He said, well, you know, Nozick isn't really a systematic thinker. He just kind of flitted from one thing to another. We don't really have to take him all that seriously. And that's a view I really can't accept, you see. Now, John wants to know, is Nozick's argument that multiple protection agencies become one state, or that one agency devolves into a state? Well, it's more that you start off with competing agencies, and one of them becomes more powerful than the other, and then clients go over to that, and that becomes a dominant agency. So it's more that what is more the latter, one agency becomes a state, although he does consider the possibility that agencies, the multiple agencies, just denied on some agreement on appeals, and he considers that to be a minimal state also. And I've suggested he's probably wrong to do that, but just they agree on appeals procedure wouldn't make them a minimal state. So he's really recognizing both. Now let's see, here's one from Reiner. Doesn't the assumption that government does not need to forget the fact that other cultures are deeply found in different government cultural ideologies, namely socialism, fascism, theocracy, etc. In a world of different cultures, isn't it necessary to have a government to defend the civil liberties of each of its own citizens? Well, then there'd be the question, why couldn't competing protection agencies do that? Why would we need a government to do it? Okay, we have a few more minutes. Now, one question I'd like to ask people, from the way I presented it, do you find what I'm doing when I present the argument too complicated, or am I basically going on a level that people can follow? You know, I know some of these details are a bit intricate, but do you think, is this all right, or am I making it too complicated, do you think? Well, that's good. Ryan follows me. Good for you, Ryan. Well, I like you already. Oh, good, good. You know, I don't. Now, what country comes closer to the ideal minimal state? Well, it's hard to think of any. Maybe some of the smaller countries like Liechtenstein or something like that, but we don't really have any minimal states. Somalia. Well, yeah, I mean, they don't have much of a state at all. So that's good. Yeah, I mean, Sealand, yeah, I mean, now, I should ask people, many people in the class read not much Nozick, or not so much? Oh, Jock has read Nozick, yes. Not so much. Well, I'm just trying to give you the basic, some of the basic ideas. Yes, he's an interesting, thinker. Yes, I knew him for 20 years. I found in trying to develop any of my philosophical abilities, and I have it, a lot of what I've learned is in trying to get arguments past Nozick. If you get an argument past Nozick, you know you've done something. It's very difficult to do because he'd always be extremely good in coming up with answers to one's objection. Maybe we have time for a couple more questions. We're a bit out of time. We're almost out of time, so is there anything else? I hope to see you all next week. I see somebody has some comments on Somalia. I'm not really familiar with the situation there. I don't think I want to live there. I guess that's about it then. So I hope to see you all next week. And thanks very much for coming. Are we watching something, Ryan? I know we're Ron Paul supporter as well. I'm a Ron Paul supporter. Yes, Ron Paul is great. Thanks everybody. So I hope to see you next week. And next week I'll be back home, I hope, so I'll be broadcasting from home. Okay, thanks a lot, everybody.